From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I'm a boy and I'm a man. I'm 18 and I don't know what I want. 18.
On today's Fresh Air, Alice Cooper talks about creating his diabolical, decadent, androgynous stage persona. Turns out, the guy who wrote Welcome to My Nightmare and No More Mr. Nice Guy is a kind of charming interviewee. We conclude our hard rock and heavy metal series with Alice Cooper, coming up on Fresh Air.
I've got a baby's brain and an old man's heart. Took 18 years to get this far. Don't always know what I'm talking about. Feels like I'm living in the middle of doubt.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're concluding our series on hard rock and heavy metal with a performer whose name thrilled teenagers and scared parents in the 70s, Alice Cooper. His brand of shock rock concerts was about breaking taboos and being decadent. He wore makeup, black lingerie, and a boa constrictor. He took a hatchet to female mannequins and spit into the audience. He often ended his performances in a guillotine. As intentionally crude as the show was, some of the songs were really catchy. A few of them became big hits, like I'm 18, School's Out, and No More Mr. Nice Guy. Lots of bands have since copied Cooper's looks and theatrics. I spoke with him last spring, after the publication of his memoir in which he confessed he was addicted to golf. The book is called Golf Monster. We're going to talk about how he transformed himself from Vincent Furnier into Alice Cooper. Let's start with this 1972 Alice Cooper anthem. Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air. Alice Cooper, I mean, the Alice Cooper act is, it's theater. I mean, it's not just a concert, it's theater. It's a whole persona, and, you know, there's, like, special effects, there's a snake. I mean, there's, you know, over the years you've done, you know, things with, crude things with mannequins. Alice gets executed at the end. Why did you want to do rock as theater, as opposed to just like doing straight concerts like most people were doing at that time?
That's exactly it, right? Just what you said. The idea of just doing a straight concert with no fun in it. You know, I mean, here, rock and roll, the most theatrical music in the world, and nobody was doing anything. I would look at bands that I really admired, like The Who and the Yardbirds, the Rolling Stones, and their theatrics were built into the character. They're, you know, they had, like, Pete Townsend was very theatrical. Mick Jagger was very theatrical. But I looked at the whole stage, and you have to remember, the original band were all art students. And we looked at that, and I said, why aren't they painting that canvas? You've got this entire stage up there, and nobody's doing anything with it. I also looked around, and I said, rock and roll is full of Peter Pans. Where's Captain Hook? And I will gladly be Captain Hook. I always thought the villain always got the best lines. The villain was always the one that everybody kind of really wanted to see. And so I created this Alice Cooper character to be all of those villains wrapped up into one, you know, with a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek. I definitely, you can't do horror without having a punchline. I think you need to make the audience laugh. As if you scare them, you need to make them laugh at the same time.
Was there as much tongue-in-cheek at the start as there is now?
Not as much, even though it actually probably on a Spinal Tap level there was, you know, when things went wrong and you were trying to be so serious up there. But I think there was always a sense of humor involved. I mean, for one thing is that all of the bands, even the bands, all of the rock press, all had this opinion that if you did theatrics, you weren't a very good band because nobody had ever done it. And if we had a 10-hour rehearsal schedule, 9 hours of that was rehearsing music because we realized we had to make the cake before we could put the icing on it. And then we would spend the other hour on how are we going to make this thing look good. Well, if it's Ballad of Dwight Frye, he should be in a straitjacket. It should be a cold white light over him. he should be, you know, the audience should feel the claustrophobia. When he breaks out, well, there's the nurse that put him in it, and she's a nurse ratchet. He should, like, strangle her. And, of course, then they take him to the gallows, and they hang him. And then he comes back out in white top hat and tails, schools out, and balloons, Busby Berkeley. You know, to me, nobody had done anything, so there was it was wide open, and nobody was there to say, well, you can't do that.
There's been so many stories over the years about how you created the Alice Cooper persona. I'd love to hear you tell the story.
Well, I honestly think that it was a combination of two or three things. There was a moment there where I thought somebody needs to upset the apple cart a little bit. We were a good rock band. We lived with the Pink Floyd, and you know, we were playing gigs with the Doors and the Mothers of Invention and all that. Nobody would record us. Finally, Frank Zappa did record us and put us on Warner Brothers. But there was that moment of saying, "We're frustrated. We better do something that's going to get a lot of attention." That's when Alice was created. That's when I said, let's create this character that every parent in the world is going to hate. You know, Alice Cooper, it's a guy. It's a band of guys. We're wearing makeup. We're wearing our girlfriend's lingerie, only we've got black leather pants on and cod pieces, and we have canes. We're more of Clockwork Orange than Clockwork Orange. We were as dangerous, and we didn't mind a little bit of violence up there. We borrowed a little bit of West Side Story. This was 1970, when people were easily shocked. I always said that we were the band that drove the stake through the heart of the Love Generation. You know, we were the next thing. Well, it was so easy to shock the audience, whereas now it's impossible.
It's interesting that you thought your ticket was coming up with an act that parents would hate.
Well yeah.
Why were you thinking about parents instead of thinking about the actual audience?
Because the audience were going to go with whatever their parents hated. If we presented this character and every parent looked at Alice and said, oh no, you're not going to be that. Now, the funny thing was this. There was no bad language. I never allowed any bad language. There was no nudity. There was nothing unchristian. There was nothing. We stayed in the boundaries. But that made it even more irritating, I think, to the general public. That they couldn't really ban us because there was nothing to ban. You know, I would bring up the point, how can you ban us and then let your kids read Macbeth? There's much more blood and satanic stuff going on in Shakespeare than ever in Alice Cooper, and yet that's required reading. So they did have to, like, look at that and say, well, you're right. I said, so it's obviously, you know, against rock and roll. You don't like the idea of rock and roll. So but the thing about it was I looked at whatever happened to Baby Jane, you know, Betty Davis. And I looked at that old lady with that caked makeup on and sort of those black smeared on eyeliner.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's truly frightening. That to me is scary. And then we saw Barbarella and we saw Anita Pallenberg played the Black Queen. And I said, that's what Alice should look like right there. And, you know, and all the guys were all straight. You know, nobody was gay. But we had no problem, you know, wearing a piece of women's clothing.
Dressing in things like what? Like leather corsets and wearing makeup?
Well,
and...
yeah, sure. I wouldn't have any problem with that. As long as, I was very secure with my manhood. First of all, girls loved it.
The
girls, oh, yeah, are you kidding? Because everybody was, you know, Neil Young and Stephen Stills, and everybody was this, you know, hippie kind of look. And all of a sudden, here was this band of guys that were kind of like androgynous. And this was pre-Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
This was pre-T-Rex. This was pre, you know, everybody. All of a sudden, there was this band of guys that played really aggressive rock and roll and liked to fight. And it was just weird. It was just like this American Frankenstein in your face. You know, a lot of fun, though, because, I mean, the controversy was amazing. The urban legend at the time was half of the charm of Alice Cooper.
Now,
every city I'd go to, I'd hear some new story about me, you know.
Did you see yourself at the time as having, like, a sexually androgynous or ambiguous image? I mean, because you guys were so straight, and it was such a kind of, like, macho way of dressing in maybe women's undergarments or whatever you were wearing on stage for each concert. You know what I mean? But you didn't look like you were gay or
no.
like you were trying to be sexually or gender ambiguous at all. It looked
but
like a
you
real,
have to remember, yeah. at that time, if your name is Alice Cooper and you're wearing a great big boa, you know,
right.
and you're wearing black leather, tight black leather jeans and boots and a switchblade, and your girlfriend's slip top that's all cut up with blood all over it, and black leather gloves, and this is 1968, 69,
mm-hmm.
people are going, oh, no, my son's not going to, that's not going to be my, and so that when they walked into their room and that poster was in their son's room, why do you think that poster was in there? Because mom and dad hated it so much.
What did your mother and father think of the act?
Now, my dad was a pastor. And my dad, I grew up in a Christian church, you know, Christian background. But I was an artist now. You have to remember, I was a big Salvador Dali fan. And my dad and mom both knew my sense of humor. They knew I didn't drink. They knew I didn't take drugs. They knew I was straight as an arrow. In fact, you know, I quite enjoyed the ladies. And I was an athlete. And I was pretty well versed in the Bible. So, when they saw this character, and I explained to him, I said, Mom, I said, this is fun. I said, trust me. The fact that everybody is so outraged over this, it makes it even more fun to do. You know, and my dad got the sense of humor in it. Now, my dad was a pastor. He says, I love the music. He said, I can't buy into the lifestyle. I can't buy into the drugs and the free love thing because, you know, I don't believe in that. And he says, but the music I love. And the show, he says, I think is very funny. So my dad was a very cool guy. He got it.
I should
but
say,
he got yeah. a lot of flack. Yeah, my dad caught a lot of flack.
You know, I should mention that you said your father knew that you didn't drink or do drugs, but that changed because eventually you
oh, yeah,
did
once I moved
that,
out, when yeah. I got older. Yeah, when I got older and I got even more far away and more involved in the career, you know, nobody, when you start being in a band, you always go, okay, oh, man, I want to have a big mansion, and I want to have all kinds of, you know, Ferraris, and I want to have a, you know, this trophy girlfriend, and I want to be an alcoholic, and I want to be, no, you don't want to be an alcoholic, you don't want to be a drug addict, you never see that part coming.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
part sideswipes you, because you start out having a beer with the guys, and then you have another beer, because you got to get on the airplane, and then, you know, it's a 2-hour flight, so you're going to have a couple beers on the plane. You get in town, you got 3 interviews. Well, I'll have a couple beers and do the interviews, and then there's the show. We've got to have a couple beers there. Pretty soon you're doing a case of beer a day, and that beer now is not, it's not beer anymore, it's medicine. And that's when you're an alcoholic, is when alcohol becomes medicine.
My guest is Alice Cooper. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alice Cooper. Here's his 1973 track, Hello, Hooray.
Yeah!
there are so many stories about how you named yourself Alice Cooper. Which is the real story?
You know, it was, I wish it were more theatrical than it is, but we're sitting around and we're talking about what could we name ourselves. Now, the obvious thing is, you know, some horrific name, you know, Venom or something like that, you know, Husky Baby Sandwich or something, you know. And we're sitting there and I went, Alice Cooper. And that was the first name that came out. I said, what if it was like a little old lady's name, a little old librarian, you know, but this little old librarian is like a serial killer. You know, nobody ever suspects her. It sounds like a little girl, Alice Cooper, a little sweet little girl. And they get us. And we all kind of like that idea, the fact that nobody would see us coming. They would, you know, in fact, my wife, when she auditioned to be in the show as a ballerina, they said, okay, this is for Alice Cooper. And she said, who's she? You know, I mean, we sounded like a blonde folk singer. Some little blonde folk singer from, you know, Pasadena. And what we were, I mean, we were actually pre-Clockwork Orange, and Clockwork Orange borrowed an awful lot of Alice Cooper. The cod pieces, the canes, the snakes, the makeup. The guy's name was Alex, not Alice.
Uh-huh.
There was a ton of Alice Cooper in Clockwork Orange.
You mentioned in your memoir that as a kid, you know, you were an athlete, you wrote for the high school paper, you were pretty popular, you were cool, but you couldn't fight. So when you're on stage and you were being like the scary villain character, the horror character, did that kind of make up for,
yeah,
for not
oh,
being
no,
able
I
to fight
created,
when you were a kid?
I created a character that had no problem with fighting. You know, mm-hmm. I created a character that almost went beyond fighting. This guy was like, he was Bela Lugosi and you know, every horrific character you could imagine. I wanted Alice, when the lights came up and Alice was there, for the audience to go, a collective,
so
that's what I wanted out of Alice.
Was there any kind of compensatory aspect to it because you couldn't fight as a kid, but here you were being this, like, scary guy?
Well, you know, the funny thing was it wasn't that I couldn't fight. It was the fact that, in fact, I was from Detroit, where you better. I got in a lot of fights when I was a little kid in Detroit. And then when we moved back to Detroit, again, back to the toughest neighborhoods in the world, it wasn't that I couldn't fight. It just that I was the great diplomat. I was the dark side of Ferris Bueller. I could talk my way out of a sunburn, you know, and I was always good at talking my way out of it. You know, I always said, why would you want to beat up me? I weigh 100 pounds. You know, the guy was going to beat me up, and I'd go, I'll tell you what, name me a girl in this school and I'll get you a date with her.
Could you do that? Could you deliver?
Oh, absolutely. The girls loved us.
How would you do it?
You know,
how would you get the date?
I was just a charmer. I was an absolute charmer. I'd go to the girl and I'd go, hey, look, you know, you're the best looking girl in school. I mean, everybody knows that. And this guy over here is going to kill me if you don't do this. You know, could you just do me a favor and go out with this guy? And honestly, I'll owe you a big favor after this. And now, you have to remember now, in high school, we were the biggest band in Phoenix. We played at the best club in Phoenix. And we had a record on the charts when we were in high school. We owned that school. We owned everything about it. And on top of it, we were athletes. We were four-year lettermen. We had the jocks covered. We had the, you know, we had the everybody out there. And honestly, nobody could beat me up because I was in the letterman's club. They'd get killed by the football team. You couldn't beat up a letterman, you know. So, I mean, honestly, we had that school so wired. It was unbelievable.
I find it so kind of amusing that you're so, like, easy to talk to and you are such a charmer, and how different that is from the Alice Cooper stage image.
Well, the Alice character has never, ever talked to the audience. I mean, when I created this character, I said, well, what would he do? What wouldn't he do? You know, you have to remember now, Alice is my favorite rock star. I create Alice to be what would I want to see this character do. And I talk about Alice in the third person because when I play Alice, I play him in the third person. And so would Alice say thank you? No. Alice wouldn't get up there and go, gee, I hope you like us tonight. Here's a song we wrote in 1968. And Alice gets up there and grabs him by the throat and says, come here, you're mine. It's almost he's almost the dominatrix.
Right.
You know, and the audience is a trick as far as he's concerned. You know, now at the end of the show, during the encore, when I come back out, I take the makeup off. And that's when it's, hey, everybody, this is the band, da, 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 da. And I talk very freely to the audience. Why? Because the makeup's not there and it's not Alice anymore.
What were some of your favorite horror films that helped inspire Alice?
Well, now, I was a kid. Now, you have to remember, in the 50s. So on Saturdays, Mom dropped us off at the theaters, and there were three or four great horror movies. It Came from Outer Space, The Thing, all those great 50s movies, and 30 Cents, and you were there all day. And now, of course, they're camp, you know, and Creature from the Black Lagoon and all that stuff. But I learned to really enjoy those kind of movies, and I think maybe collectively that's where I started creating Alice.
Alice Cooper will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I used to be such a sweet, sweet thing till they got a hold of me. I opened doors for little old ladies. I helped the blind to see. I got no friends because they read the papers. They can't be
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Alice Cooper brings out the guillotine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alice Cooper. He became famous in the 70s for his intentionally decadent, taboo-breaking theatrical rock concerts. Here's his 1975 recording, Welcome to My Nightmare.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down. Just a dream here. You know inside you feel right at home here. You're welcome to my nightmare, yeah.
Alice Cooper's shows usually end with him being executed on stage.
I asked what's his favorite way of being executed.
Well, nothing's more effective than the guillotine. Because the guillotine, there's a certain amount of real anticipation behind it. You see that blade.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 40-pound blade. It's razor sharp, and it really only misses me by about 6 inches.
It's a real guillotine.
Oh, yeah, and it's a good trick. But if I didn't do the trick right, it would cut my head off. I mean, it's you have, don't try this at home, by the way. I'm a professional.
Can you describe
in case
the
any
trick,
of you people have guillotines at
away?
Home. Well, it's a trick. It's an old vaudeville trick. In fact, you know, when guys like Groucho Marx would come to the show, Groucho saw us as the last, he always called me, he says, you're the last hope for vaudeville. And he would bring Jack Benny and George Burns and Mae West, and people like that would come to the show because it was vaudeville to them. They said, I remember 1923, the great Floyd used to do that. You know, remember the fighter. Of course, he would have doves come out of his sleeves. And this was nothing new to these guys. They would, you know, Groucho would come to the show and he'd see it and he'd go, you know, he'd insult everybody there. Excuse me, I've got to go insult the Major D. You know, that kind of thing. And we were best of friends, Groucho and I were. But they saw it as vaudeville, and actually that's what it is. It's rock and roll vaudeville. But this generation, the last five generations, have no idea what vaudeville is. So to them, it's something new. It's some kind of strange, dark cabaret.
So can you describe the guillotine trick, like how it's done?
Well, the guillotine, you are in the guillotine in a stock, right? And you are holding yourself up with the hands. The audience sees your head in the stock. And there's a basket in front of you. What they don't see is that when the guillotine comes down, at one point you let yourself go and your whole body drops. Okay? They don't see that. They only see your head lop off. They see your, because they only see your head fall down. And then there's a fake back that comes up and gives it the illusion that your head literally came off. And if you see it on video, it is so effective that you can stop it and start it, and that head comes off. Now, we learned the trick. It was an old vaudeville trick. But it had been perfected. The great Randy was one of the guys that helped us with it. And it looks perfect. In other words, I wouldn't do it unless it really did look good. And then, of course, there's another head in the basket.
Right, that they
there's
can
a perfect Alice
around.
Head.
Yeah.
That then they pull it out.
Uh-huh.
It's my head. And by that time, I'm already off the stage. I'm already gone. I'm already changing into white top hat and tails.
So, you know, at the end of a show, there's always a sense of relief and release, you know, that the show is done.
Yeah.
It must be particularly so when you're getting executed at the end.
Well, there's not much more you can do. I mean, your head just came off. And I always say that, you know, if you're in the first 10 rows, don't wear your best clothes. Because when that head comes off, we make sure that everybody gets, that an artery goes. And, you know, it sprays blood over everybody. You know, people are covered in stage blood. But they want to be close as they can get so they can walk out with the blood splattered all over them and say, you know, Alice got me with the blood tonight. It was great, you know. And then, of course, the guy, the executioner, pulls the head out, and the head is rigged so that he looks at the head, he talks to it, and he turns around, and the head spews blood out of its mouth into the audience, like it throws up what's left of it. It's not dead yet, you know. Now, it's so over the top that if you're not laughing by now, there's something wrong with you.
But the thing is, though, that some of your fans took it really seriously,
well,
which leads to the chicken story. It leads to the chicken story.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell the chicken story.
Well, no, the chicken story was one of those things that nobody saw that one coming. We're playing in Toronto, and my manager, Shep Gordon, who I've been with 38 years, who's also total vaudeville, totally gets it, you know. He's the one guy that always goes, let's go for the Hollywood publicity stunt, you know. We're going to go on between John Lennon and the Doors. Now you have to remember, nobody's ever heard of us, but he promoted the concert and 60,000 people there. And we didn't get paid. Our payment was that we went on at the end between the two biggest acts. So in the end of our show, we always used to do a thing where we would open up a feather pillow and CO2 cartridges, and the whole stage was a flurry of feathers. One or two pillows could fill Madison Square Garden, you know, with a CO2 cartridge. In the middle of all this, all of a sudden, I look down and there's a chicken. Somebody threw a chicken on stage. Now, it never occurred to me, here's a guy, I say, I got my keys, I got my tickets, I got my drugs, I got my chicken. Who would bring a chicken to a rock concert? It wasn't us. We didn't bring it. I mean, I'd never thought of using a chicken on stage. So there's this white chicken. And being from Detroit, never being on a farm in my life, it had feathers, it had wings, it was a bird. It should be able to fly. Is that not logical?
Oh, I understand.
I understand. And I pick it up and I kind of like softly, you know, throw it into the audience where it didn't fly as much as it plummeted into the audience, and the audience tore it to pieces.
Yeah,
next day in the paper, Alice Cooper rips chicken apart and drinks the blood, and I was the new geek of all time. Of course, nobody had a picture of it because it didn't happen. Now, I got a call the next day from Frank Zappa, who was producing me at the time, and he goes, Alice, did you kill a chicken on stage last night? And I went, no. He says, well, don't tell anybody. They love it. He says, everybody's talking about it. He says, you're the new, you know. So
I guess there's a part of me that wonders if, in a way, Alice wasn't the villain here, in the sense that maybe the fans were kind of behaving the way they thought you wanted them to behave, or the way they were expected to behave at an Alice Cooper concert. You know, a chicken, yeah, we're villains too. Let's get the chicken.
That could be it. And it also could be the fact that they were the ones that were high. We weren't. We were in the band. We didn't get high. We drank a little beer. That was about it.
But did you ever think, like, what am I bringing out in my fans? Am I making these people a little weird and crazy and violent?
Not violent, because here's the strange thing. We never had violence in our audience. That was always the odd thing. My show was designed to this day that if you look away from the stage, you're going to miss something. And that I've always shotgun theater. You know, this song happens. Boom, that's happening. Alice has got a crutch up there. Okay, the crutch is gone. Now he's got a sword. The sword's got money on it. Now there's money flying in the air. Da-da. We don't give them a chance to look away from the stage. So we never have fights in the audience. We never have people getting in trouble. You take a boring act and put them up there, and the audience will fight. But not during an Alice Cooper concert.
Well, here's one other thing I'm wondering about, like the act, you know, the theater. Like, there was one song in which you would have these, dismembered parts of female mannequins.
Just parts of any mannequins, yeah.
Yeah, but do really crude things with them. And I'm thinking of specifically here, the female mannequins.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, that makes me wonder, like, what message is that sending, or what impact is it having on, like, the youngest male members of your audience, who think, like, yeah, that's what sexual is.
Yeah, and the weird thing about it was, at that time, I think I only did that once, and I think that was in the Billion Dollar Baby show.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And it never returned after that.
Oh, okay.
But it was, at the time, it was very Dada. It was very Salvador Dali-esque. There was no phallus. There was nothing. It was obviously mannequin parts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people said, Alice Cooper, oh, kill babies on stage. No, I killed dolls on stage, baby dolls. And Alice had this thing where you'd throw billion-dollar babies. On billion-dollar babies, I would throw baby dolls in the audience, you know, little rubber baby dolls. And I would have one on the end of my sword, and I would throw it out there. The song Dead Babies was about parental abuse. It had nothing to do with killing babies. It said, yeah, killing babies, because parents aren't taking care of their babies. I had nothing against babies, but I did like throwing dolls around. I thought there was something about that. Maybe it was having a big sister or something like that. I was always afraid to bring a psychiatrist to my show. I was afraid they'd read too much into it. But it was always, the funny thing about it was, if Salvador Dali would have done that, people would have gone, ooh, that's very artistic, you know. But Alice Cooper does it, and they go, oh, I don't know about that.
My guest is Alice Cooper. His new memoir is called Alice Cooper, Golf Monster. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alice Cooper. He has a new memoir about music and golf. It's called Alice Cooper, Golf Monster. You know what I find almost amusing? Like, the stage show is so much, like, darker and more malevolent than a lot of the records themselves are. I mean, like, and some of the records, and this is the 70s we're talking about,
yeah.
But, like, take Desperado, which is, you know, has a lyric like, I wear lace and I wear black leather.
Yeah.
You
know what that song
is? You know, my hands are
about?
On my gun, and my shots are clean. My shots are final. But the music, like, there's an instrumental break in the music where there's like symphonic violins playing, and it's so like this symphonic music break in the middle
right.
of that song is so different from anything that the Alice Cooper theater image would present. It's
now
like,
that song in particular mm-hmm. was my favorite movie was The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, I love that film.
Okay, now remember Robert Vaughn's character? He was the guy with the black, he had the black vest on, he had the two chrome guns, he was the fastest gun, he was the gambler, he had the white lace shirts, and song was written about him.
Oh.
I wear lace and I wear black leather, my hands are lightning on my six guns, my shots are clean, my shots are final, and it was about him. And of course, I always loved the idea that the audience was allowed to make up their own interpretations. I always said the best thing you can do here is don't write a story. Bombard the audience with images and then take 10 people and ask them what happened in that show, and they'll tell you 10 different things.
My guest is Alice Cooper. Let's hear the track we've been talking about, Desperado.
I'll wear lace. And I wear black leather. My hands are lightning up on my gun. My shots are clean. My shots are final. My shots are deadly. And when it's done, you're as stiff as
That's Desperado by my guest, Alice Cooper. So how did you end up having, orchestral instrumental breaks on Alice Cooper
Bob Ezrin.
Records?
Bob Ezrin was our George Martin. Now, we were a pretty raw rock and roll band, a very inventive rock and roll band. And we learned from the Yardbirds and the Who, and we really were a very good rock band and with a lot of good little hooky ideas. Now, Bob Ezrin came along. He was our producer from Toronto, worked with Jack Richardson, and he saw it and said, I'm going to take and shape this into something that is purely Alice Cooper. It has Alice Cooper signature all over it. We quit touring for 6, 7, 8 months maybe and did nothing but relearned how to play our instruments, relearned how to sing, relearned how to write. And that's when Love It to Death came out with Ballad of Dwight Frye and Desperado and those songs and everything like that. And it was a new Alice, but it was an Alice that was really melodic.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Ezrin would say, he would do this. We would, of course, hear a song and we would add guitars and add this and add this. Bob would subtract things. He would say, let's take all of this out and just have that one piano going there. It's one lonely little piano. And then this whole wave of strings will come in. He says, and they're not expecting that. And when those strings are just like singing above everything with your voice here in the middle, then the guitar comes in. But one guitar, not six guitars. And pretty soon we would argue with him and say, you're taking all the best parts out. Then we'd listen to it and go, oh, man, that's great. You know, Bob really, we gave him full rein. We would write the songs, record it, and then we would let him add the oboe here that like doubled the bass. And he would add a piano that doubled that guitar. And this and this and this. And it was magnificent.
Yeah, well, even Welcome to My Nightmare has horns in it.
Oh, it's got
some
all
phonic
kinds of
sounding horns.
Elected is sounds like a Leonard Bernstein piece. You know, but that's all Bob Ezrin.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Cooper. And he has a new book that's part memoir about his life and his band. And it's also part about golf. And it's called Golf Monster. And he describes himself as a golf addict. Now, we talked a little bit about how when you were growing up, you know, your father was a pastor. Your grandfather had been the head of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Yes, not LDS. It was a Protestant church.
Not a Mormon church.
No, not at all. No. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was called the Church of Jesus Christ, but there was no LDS after it.
Right. So with people, with a father and grandfather who were so active in their churches and who were, you know, missionaries too.
Yes.
When you started doing Alice Cooper, was there ever a little voice in your head saying, I am behaving sinfully?
I was the prodigal son. I couldn't get further away from the church. I became the poster boy for sin. I was, you know, pretty much you couldn't get much worse than Alice Cooper. Of course, I was getting richer and bigger. And we were voted number one band in the world at one point, combined with hit records. That was what kept me going, was the fact that there were hit records and people couldn't deny that. Sold out shows everywhere. Now, when I got out there and I became an alcoholic and there was that voice that said, what are you doing out here? Because I did believe in Jesus Christ. I did believe in God. In fact, a lot of my songs in the early days, there was a song called Second Coming. A lot of my songs had lots of biblical reflections and things going on. Now, about 1980, I checked into a hospital because I was throwing up blood in the morning. Mm. And I came out of the hospital. I was the classic alcoholic. I couldn't walk from A to B without a drink in my hand. I came out of the hospital and never once had a craving for alcohol. Not one craving. I didn't go to AA. Didn't have a therapist. Didn't have a psychiatrist. I had no backup. I just went, it's gone. It's absolutely gone. So people said, well, you had a very good cure. I said, no, I was healed.
So is that when you became a Christian again?
Well, it was when I saw the evidence of the fact that God did something extraordinary with me. He for not because I deserved it, but it was as though one day they took a X-ray and I had cancer, let's say, and they took the X-ray the next day and the cancer was totally gone. And they went, where did it go? It just disappeared. I was an alcoholic of the highest order one day. When I came out, I was not. 26 years, I've never had a drink. And it would never occur to me to have a drink.
My guest is Alice Cooper. His new memoir is called Alice Cooper, Golf Monster. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
My guest is Alice Cooper. He has a new memoir about music and golf. It's called Alice Cooper, Golf Monster. Can I just name a few names for you and get your really short take on them?
Sure.
Great. Kiss.
Kiss. We told Kiss where to buy their makeup. Everybody wanted there to be a huge feud between Kiss and us because they were the great copycats. Alice came out with the makeup. Kiss came out with the makeup. Their very first statement was, if one Alice works, then four ought to work. Now, my joke with them, and they're friends of mine, was they use pyro. I never used pyro. I said, as long as you guys don't do my show and do different records, there's room for us both out here. Just don't be Alice Cooper. So they turned into four comic book characters. Mm-hmm. They were like the X-Men, mm-hmm. whereas Alice Cooper was Phantom of the Opera, you know. I always used to laugh, and I say, when you guys can't think of anything clever to do, you just blow something up.
Okay, Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Based on Alice Cooper.
Right.
Absolutely. I saw the director's notes. Every time they mentioned Frankenfurter, they said, a la Alice Cooper. Uh-huh. Now, see, that show had a great sense of humor. You know, I mean, you watch that. I don't care if you were Christian or non-Christian. You watch the show, and you were laughing your head off because it was so ridiculous. But it's so over-the-top vaudeville that, I mean, you have to laugh at it. I object to some of the humor. I object to some of the, you know, things. But so what? You know, everybody's going to object to something.
Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn Manson, you know, understood what Alice was, looked at it and said, I'm just going to up the ante. I'm going to be Marilyn Manson. Okay, Alice Cooper, Marilyn Manson. Okay, let me see a girl's name. Gee, I wish I would have thought of that. Makeup. Oh, wait a minute. I did that. But he said, okay, my thing is, now Alice did makeup, snakes, and violence, mock violence on stage. Okay, what am I going to do? Okay, I'm going to be a devil worshiper, drug addict, da-da-da. That'll get him. What he does is very stylistic.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's missing the sense of humor in it, and I certainly object to a lot of the things when it comes to tearing pages out of the Bible. And he became an anti-Alice as soon as he heard I was Christian.
Really?
He just publicly said, Alice is, I hate Alice now. Why? Because he's Christian.
And I want to ask you about Frank Sinatra, and here's why. In a concert film from 1973, you come out first in a white tuxedo singing The Lady is a Tramp, a song
she
Sinatra made famous.
She gets too hungry for dinner at 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was the first punk.
Wait. Then you say in the middle of a song, you go, I've had enough of this, and you act like really angry, and you strip out of the out of the tuxedo and start getting into Alice Cooper drag. But I figured you must love Sinatra.
Loved Sinatra. He actually was a friend. And Frank Sinatra totally got Alice Cooper. In fact, all of the Hollywood guys, the old pros, got Alice Cooper. They got it. They understood what it was. They saw the image. They said, oh, I get it. Okay, cool. He's playing this thing to the hilt. Way to go. And the hit records keep coming. Frank Sinatra did one of my songs. He did You and Me at the Hollywood Bowl one night. I actually got along quite well with Frank Sinatra. He looked at me as an original. And, of course, everybody, you can't beat Sinatra. He's the best voice of all time.
Just one more thing. It sounds like your voice is in pretty good shape, which is kind of amazing considering how many years you've been singing real out on stage. Is that it?
Yeah. Never mm-hmm. smoked. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I never wasn't a smoker. And I quit drinking 26 years ago. A lot of the guys I know, I mean, the Steven Tylers and the Iggy's and people like that that were heavy smokers, yeah, do have some problem with lungs. I mean, as far as lung power. Now, you have to remember, on top of that, I was a distance runner.
Right.
I mean, so I can get up and do 5 shows a week, 2 hours a night, at a much more breakneck pace than these guys do. And it's because that I think that I never had a lung problem. I didn't have problems with that.
Well, Alice Cooper, it's really been fun talking with you.
Well, thank you very much. We had done some fun stuff.
Alice Cooper, concluding our hard rock heavy metal series. Our interview was recorded last spring after the publication of his memoir, Golf Monster. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm a man. I'm 18.
NPR comes from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Walt, co-author of a controversial new book that argues the pro-Israel lobby in America has played a key role in shaping American policies in the Middle East. Then we'll hear from Abraham Foxman, director of the Anti-Defamation League, who has written a new book in response. Join us for the next Fresh Air.